All right. So I'm really delighted to introduce today's presenter, Danny Kingsley. Danny has been involved in open access for many years. I know that many of you will know her. Most recently, she was the Deputy Director at Cambridge University Libraries for Scholarly Communications. But her previous role to that was Executive Officer of the Australasian Open Access Strategy Group when it was the Australian group. Obviously, it's the Australasian one now. And she did all the work really to kick this group's work off, to establish the website, to establish its presence, and was very important in getting it going. Before that, she spent 4 years as the manager of scholarly communications and publishing at the Australian National University, and that's where her PhD was from, on looking at the barriers to opening up access to science communications. Before that, she worked as a science communicator and she worked at the ABC as a journalist and also a co-producer of health programmes. So I'm going to hand over to Danny. She's going to share her screen. And as I said, if you've got any questions, please hold them to the end. We'll be delighted to answer them then.
Okay. Hi, everyone. I'm just going to sort this sharing of screen out. So hopefully you can now see the opening slide. So there we are. Beautiful. All right, great. Lovely to speak to you all virtually today. Thank you very much for this invitation. I'm going to be talking today about some of the things that have been going on in the European and UK context, and hopefully give a bit of an overview of where things are up to in relation to quite a few aspects of the scholarly communication discussion. The slides are comprehensive. I've made them available on SlideShare, and obviously AOSG will make them available as well. So don't panic if I work through slides fairly quickly, because they are available and a lot of things are there just for demonstration purposes. So I've got five things I want to discuss. I'm just trying to work out how heavy. No, that's not. Hang on, if I go that way. Oh, Ginny, I'm sort of having trouble here actually progressing the slides on the second screen.
Okay, hold on a moment, we'll give you a hand.
So what I might do is just share a different screen for now, and that will at least give you if I share this screen. Yeah. Okay. So I've now shared the screen with the pictures down the side, so you can see yourselves if your video's up. So hopefully you can see the five things to discuss today. Could you give me the thumbs up, Ginny, if you can see five things to discuss? Perfect. Okay, let's do that. All right, this is our solution. So you may notice some alliteration in this slide. So I'm doing five topics, talking about cancellations, talking about issues to do with the credibility of science, metrics, the policy scenario, and just a little bit of a word of warning at the end about blindsiding. Okay, so first thing is issues about cancellation, cascading cancellation. So certainly in the UK, where a lot of money was pumped into, extra money was pumped into open access, we ended up, obviously, as institutions, particularly ones like Cambridge, which is a research-intensive institution, paying a lot of extra money into the system. And so what was ending up happening was offsetting agreements, where not just a sort of top slice blanket on reduction on subscription costs was being brought in, but also actually you have spent X amount in our subscription and Y amount in terms of a APC cost, so we're going to give you a percentage of that back. So that's sort of helpful on an institutional basis, but it wasn't really enough. And so what ended up happening is quite a lot, just in the last year alone, quite a lot of cancellations have been occurring, and you're probably aware of quite a few of these. And they're not all Elsevier, that's the other thing to think about. So there's a whole lot of consortia, country-level consortia, which is like us here in Call doing the negotiations on behalf of the whole sector, where the consortia have just walked away. So Norway and Hungary and Sweden and Germany have all walked away from Elsevier. University of California quite recently did so as well. But the French National Consortium has cancelled their subscription to Springer Nature, and the Dutch Consortium ended up not being able to make an agreement with the Royal Society of Chemistry. So this is not just an Elsevier issue, this is a big deal issue, and it's across multiple places. So what that has meant is we've had some outcomes. Now, not all of those are necessarily positive. So in February 2018, so last year, Germany was saying, this is great, because they hadn't actually been cut off while the negotiations were still continuing with Elsevier. And they were saying, look, we're saving all this money, £8.7 million per year. It's great. Isn't this wonderful? And then actually what happened in July, not many months later, is that Elsevier did cut off access to Sweden and Germany. Now, there's an article that's referenced there. In February 2019, Nature wrote an article about how it's going. And what's interesting about that article is there's a very distinct difference between the way the researchers responded to how it was going and the librarians did. So the researchers were saying things like, this is damaging research, it's punishing us, it's causing unnecessary delay. Whereas the libraries were going, look, we're saving lots of money and we're able to fulfill all our requests. Now, there's, to me, quite a distinct difference in whether that's a positive or a negative thing, depending on which perspective you have. Nature article didn't really kind of go into that in much depth, but I really felt that that there's more unpicking there about whether or not this is actually working for everybody. So one of the things that have happened is we've got lots of different types of deals now. So these are three different deals. So Elsevier with Norway, Cambridge University Press with the University of California, and German institutes with Wiley. So different publishers are coming up with different types of deals with different areas, areas. So they're all different models. So one of them, the Norway one, is saying that we'll give you a 3% pricing increase, but there's a gold open access clause. So you'll be able to publish your work open access if you just give us that little bit of extra money. The focus was different. It was on a green. So they had a price reduction over their agreement, but they have built-in green open access within the agreement. So it's a different approach. California's agreement with the Cambridge University Press is a sliding scale. And I did talk to them a while ago about this, and I wonder if that conversation sort of fed into this discussion. But the idea being that I was saying we don't want to pay more overall. That's the problem. So what needs to happen is there's more open access content. There should be less expenditure on subscriptions. And that's basically what they've done. It's a sliding scale. In Germany, there is an annual fee based on the number of papers they'll publish, and that kind of works out to be about what they were spending already. So these are all quite different deals from one another, and the way this sort of seems to be playing out is that Wiley may have that kind of deal with Germany, but may strike a different deal with a different consortium somewhere else. So it's very, very complex, this arrangement. So what are the implications of this cascading cancellation situation? One of them is, if you are going to start doing deals with publishers on the amount you're paying already on article processing charges, you need to know how much you're paying on article processing charges. Now, even within an environment like the UK, where you're given large block grants from what is now UK Research and Innovation, and also from the Wellcome Trust, so it's centrally managed and you keep a control on that amount of money, there's still extra money that's being paid out of the system that's unknown, out of other grants or out of people's individual budgets and so on. Here, obviously, in Australia, where we don't have block grants, we don't really have the faintest idea. So there is some work being done at different levels. Conor Call's doing some work, and there's been some work done at the University of Sydney on trying to understand how to even go about quantifying this information. Also, the other question is, do you know how many of your institution publications have gold or if something's open access, is it open access for fully gold, open access, or is it through a hybrid journal? Now, this matters because we're getting into a situation now where funding is being provided where people are no longer able to use those funds on hybrid journals. So having that kind of understanding would be enormously helpful in terms of advising our research community. And the last thing is, why are we not including institutional contribution into our discussions with the research, with the publishers? And by institutional contribution, I mean not just the money we give them through subscriptions and through article processing charges, but the in-kind we give them in terms of obviously providing the articles in the first place, refereeing work, and also editing work. That work is hidden and is not quantified and is contribution in and should be actually considered when we start talking about giving them extra money in the form of, say, subscriptions. So I did some work on that in Cambridge, but I'm not going to talk about that now. You can ask me about it later on. We've got more to get on with. Okay, moving on to the second point, which is credibility crunch point. So this is our new reality. We are living in a post-truth world. And that causes a problem for us in the scientific area. So during the pre-Brexit vote, and gosh, that was a joy living in the UK during that experience. But anyway, there was a comment that was made by Michael Gove, which was that we've had enough of experts. Now, in this instance, he was talking about economists, but that general philosophy that experts are somewhere the other and that the real people don't need them is very much a narrative that's becoming quite prevalent and one that's really concerning. This is a situation that was happening 2018. Scott Pruitt's no longer in this role, but he was the Environmental Protection Agency, and the decision was made that he alone will decide what is and isn't acceptable science when developing policies that affect health and the environment. Now, given that Mr. Pruitt's a lawyer, this is extremely concerning because he probably doesn't really know. Now, he resigned in July 2018, and it's good to know that his replacement, Andrew Wheeler, is a former coal lobbyist, so it's excellent that he's now in charge of the Environment Protection Agency. Anyway, this morning on the Campus Morning Mail, there was an article that came in which was talking about, and not so much this political implication, but more the sort of kind of publicity perspective of trying to sell science and make it sexy. And the problem is that this creates a sort of community distrust of institutions and people's beliefs in their own self-interest trumping evidence. It's the same problem, the post-truth problem. Good thing is that there is actually faith in scientists, not necessarily in science institutions. So that's actually a positive to take from that. But this is a quote from Stephen Hawking not long before he died, and he was talking about the way politicians cherry pick evidence to push a particular political point, and this is it's completely unacceptable in terms of the scientific method and the credibility of science. So we've got a problem. Now, this slide is quoting this slide talks about a situation, and it's one that's very familiar, which is incipient and actual attacks on the integrity of science. And I think we can say that that is what's happening. And the solution is an institution under attack must re-examine its foundations, restate its objectives, seek out its rationale. Crisis invites self-appraisal. Now, that comes from 1942. It's from some work done by a sociologist of science, Robert K. Merton, and he wrote about the normative structure of science. So that was that quote is from the introduction to this chapter of Normative Structure of Science. It's an enormous book. What he talked about is that science has some sort of norms, some bases within the process that kind of make it science. And they are pretty much that it doesn't matter who it is that finds something. If it's scientifically valid, it is scientifically valid. You can't dismiss something just on the basis of who's found it out. The idea of communalism, so that everybody owns it, everybody has access to scientific outputs. The idea of disinterestedness, that you're doing it for the greater good, not for personal gain. And this is something that may come up a bit later in this discussion. And the third one is organised scepticism. The term peer review didn't come into the lexicon until about 1975. So he's referring to organised scepticism in this area, but this was written in 1942, so there wasn't really a term for it. So what's happening? How is the scientific community meeting this? Well, there's a few things happening. One of them, there's some work on by the Open Science Framework, which is the Reproducibility Project, and looking at reproduction of different projects and seeing if those findings from the original research can actually be replicated. They can't always be. There's been work that's just been done in the UK on research integrity. So there was a big inquiry from the Science and Technology Committee. It was truncated because there was a general election right in the middle of it, so it got stopped and then started again. But it's now complete. And certainly my submission to it was, well, the problem we have is the scientific reward system, and that's perverting behaviour. So we need to look at that. And so there's been a lot of work in the UK on the question of integrity, scientific integrity. Another one is in the US, which is the National Academies of Science, Engineering and Medicine, who now have a committee on reproducibility and replicability in science. And there's also in the UK a UK Reproducibility Network. And this is pulled together by people within the scientific community from different disciplines who are interested in this area, who are working around the discussions here. Now, the implications this has for us, or for the scientific community, for Australia, is that this agenda is a very positive one, actually, because it's looking at the causes of the problems, and academic reward structure, of course, is, at least in my opinion, a big one. But it also identifies potential solutions for this issue. And so things like registering studies before research is done, and then that's very sort of established in clinical trials now, for example. The credit taxonomy, which indicates with the paper who did what in the research process and so on. These are good things. These are really beneficial things, I think, that actually increase the integrity of the scientific record. And a lot of them relate to the open research agenda. And the thing that's really important about this is it's the scientific, it's the community owning the issue. And that's the strongest place for us to be, is to own it. All right, so let's now look at, let's now look at why this is happening. What is, what's the cause? Why are we even having this conversation in the first place? So, metrics. There's been a huge amount of work, certainly in the last sort of 4 or 5 years in the UK, on the question of metrics. So there was a big report that was released in July 2015 called The Metric Tide, and it was an independent review on the role of metrics in research assessment and management. The conclusion was that there is too much weighting on metrics. This is causing problems. One of the things that's come out of that is the equivalent of Universities Australia, which is Universities UK, now have a forum for responsible research metrics, and that's doing a lot of work. It's doing sort of study work. It's got lots of events that they're running. There's opening up the discussion around this question about metrics. Metrics is also a very big focus of the European Commission. They have the Open Science Policy Platform, and they've got 8 priorities, and one of those priorities is research indicators and next generation metrics. So this is very much the focus. It's all over the UK and Europe. So there's lots of individual funding environments and institutional environments, there's discussion on responsible metrics. Now, what I think is interesting is if you look, most of these pages, or certainly all of these ones, are library web pages. So what these are is normally research counting and the quantification of research is sort of owned by the research office. But in this instance, it's more than counting research. It's actually understanding the counting of research within the context of scholarly communication. And scholarly communication very much sits within the library environment, not the research office environment. So this is an area where the libraries have really started to step up and sort of take position themselves within institutions to say, we know about this, we can help the institution in this area. Now, the question about responsible metrics comes into funding now. So DORA, the Declaration on Research Assessment, is now linked to some funding areas. So for example, the Wellcome Trust is now saying that they will not provide funds for organisations that do not sign or publicly declare support for DORA. Now, this is important. If you need to find out if your institution is Wellcome Trust funded, if there are any Wellcome Trust funds in your institution, and if there are, you're going to need to go and talk to the research office, because I can pretty much guarantee they're unaware of this requirement, and talk to them about the implications for your institution in relation to DORA. Because when we look at the Australian signatories to DORA, there are no universities, not one Australian university to date has signed up to DORA. So there are a few research institutes that have, in relation to obviously areas that have presumably a reasonable amount of Wellcome Trust funding because they are medically focused. The National Health and Medical Research Council has also signed up to DORA. But no institutions. Now, you might say, oh, all institutions, surely they just have to sign up to DORA. It doesn't mean anything has to change. Well, maybe. So what we're going to look at is incentives for certain publication behaviour. Now, having incentives for publication in themselves is not problematic. We've got here 2 instances which are perfectly fine. These are instances where there is support for publication for people who may not normally have support, who might be early career researchers or high degree research students, and all the requirements are is that the research output would be ERA compliant, and then we'll provide you support. That's fine, there's nothing wrong with that. But there is, from a DORA's perspective, something wrong with both of these. Now, these are 2 institutions of probably several. There were the 2 I found quickly. We've got 2 instances here where there are cash incentives for publication in Nature or Science. Now, that is a problem from a DORA point of view. And then let's think back to the disinterested question as well in relation to the formal Mertonian norms of science. It does start to bring that into question as well. Now, that's its own issue. We might not worry about DORA so much, but why are we worried? What's the problem with relying on metrics? What's the problem with focusing down on publication of novel results in high-impact journals? Surely that's what we all want. Well, there are issues because what it's doing is it's really making people risk-averse. So it's like a theatre group who say, oh, we better put on another Noel Coward play because people will come along to that and they won't put on the new playwright's work. So restricting the availability of new and novel ideas. And it's the same thing that's happening in science. So it's been demonstrated that bold projects are not getting funding. and the risky research is undervalued, and that people are actually directing the way they write their papers to influence reviewers and editors and so on. This is problematic because this is not free and open thought. This is working to the test. And there's another issue, is that we've got this quite a serious problem, and this is worldwide, where people are starting off enthusiastic and doing a PhD and wanting to go into academia, and then, well, it's obviously hard enough to find a work in the first place, but then even when you get in, the pressure of getting grant funding is so high that we've got a lot of attrition where people are just going, I can't be bothered, it's too much, I'm just going to walk away. And that can't be good for the whole scientific enterprise. So the implications of metrics is that we've got, the problem is that the more we focus on metrics, the more we pervert the goal of the research institutions and researchers, which is presumably to do good science, do good research. And the metric insistence has gone too far, and that is actually causing problems for research. So we do need to move away from publication of novel results in high impact journals as the only thing that counts. Oh, have I mentioned open research yet? All right, let's talk about policies. This was a graphic that was pulled together by Bill Hubbard in May 2015, which was just as the whole RCUK policies were being kicked off and discussion about what was going to be done for the Research Excellence Framework, pointing out that it's an absolute dog's breakfast, which is one term I have to say does translate across Australia to the UK. It's surprising how many don't. I got caught out endlessly. Okay, so let's do a really quick sort of timeline here. This is a timeline from 1990 through to 1999. And in these timelines, on the top are sort of activities that happen in the sort of open space, and down the bottom are policies that happen in the open space. So you can see in this particular one, there are no policies in that early period before 2000. And then in the noughties, things started to kick off. So what we started having was Wellcome Trust in 2003 and 2004 started doing some investigation in this area. They brought in their open access policy. The NIH also brought in their policy. But they were voluntary policies initially, and there wasn't much take up of them. Getting towards the end of that decade, they started insisting that it was not voluntary, it was mandatory. And then we move into the teens, which is where we are now. And you can see that, again, we're starting to increase more and more on the bottom half of these timelines, and that the policy scenario is becoming more and more complex, and there's more and more in there. So we've got the Research Excellence Framework, we've got data checking, we've got the Research Excellence Framework policy beginning, the Open Research Council's UK policy ending, UKRI encompassing what was the Research Council's UK and what had been the Higher Education Funding Council for England. It's a very messy environment. So what's happened is the focus has moved on from open access. It started with open access, it moved into the idea about sharing data, and now has moved beyond that into the broader agenda of open science, open research, open scholarship. It's a bit confusing. In Europe, they call open science meaning science as sort of pursuit of knowledge. So they mean science in the broadest sense. However, in Australia and certainly in the UK, that's seen as exclusion of the arts and humanities. It's not intended as such. So language like open research or open scholarship are more inclusive. So there are some statements on open research that are now out and about, and I'm very proud to say that Cambridge University is one of them. Slightly awkwardly, announced in February that they were the first university to have a position statement on open research. They were, because it was agreed in November the previous year, but what had happened was the Reading University had announced theirs in December, and Cambridge didn't get around to announcing it until February, so I had to apologise to Reading, who were wonderfully helpful in the process for Cambridge to develop the open research statement. But what do we even mean by open research? So, well, take your pick. So there's over 90 declarations and position statements around the world on the topic of open research. And now these include things like DORA and the Leiden Manifesto for Research Metrics. So they're not all, this is what open research is. It's around the broader concept of open research, but there's many, many of them. So I'd very much suggest if you are looking at trying to build a statement on open research, build on what is already there rather than reinvent. But there's so many different definitions of open research, open science. It's now actually an attempt to define the definitions. So taxonomy plus. The other thing in the policy space, of course, is Plan S. So Plan S is a set of principles. So let's just make this clear. It's very difficult to talk about Plan S because it is a set of principles. And so until you actually have a policy, and believe me, as somebody who's had to implement multiple policies, it's not until you actually see a policy that you've really got something to talk about, but set of principles. So it was announced September last year. The guidelines were released in November, and then there was feedback that was invited against those guidelines that were had to be handed in by the beginning of February. There should be an announcement tomorrow on the feedback of the response to the feedback effectively, and what the Plan S is going to sort of morph into as a result of that. There were over 600 responses. Robert John Smits, who's one of the architects of Plan S, actually is no longer there. He departed as the European Commission Special Envoy for Open Access in February. And Robert Kiley, who's from the Wellcome Trust, is the interim coalition coordinator. So the nominal start date currently is 1st of January 2020. Whether or not that changes as a result of the feedback, we will know next. Tomorrow. Huge amounts of discussion on Plan S. So I was keeping a sort of trying to keep up to date and linking them all. I stopped adding to this on the 1st of April, and there were 67 items in 2019 to that date, and there had been 51 in the previous year since between 4th of September and the end of December. But they're only the ones I found. There are many, many others. And look, they range enormously. So this is like two extremes. Well, extremes of the kind of debate. So on the left-hand side there, you've got a rant. And it's an example of groups of people who use something like the open agenda to push their agenda. So it's very, very ranty. It's totally off the scale down one end. The other end is very supportive of the whole concept of open research and Plan S, and that we think that this is where it should be going. And so these were the early kinds of discussions. Then the feedback came, and you've got a much broader picture of what people's feedback is. And Lisa Hinchcliffe did, in an amazingly short period of time, an analysis of what the feedback kind of contained. And so there's a link to the scholarly kitchen blog that she wrote on this. But these are the themes. So generally, everyone said they supported the general idea of open access. There was concern that it's really STEM focused and it's going to affect HASS badly. Technical requirements for the repositories were just not going to be able to be met. There was going to be risk for learned societies. The ABC, the idea of a fair APC, is all very good and well, but not sure that that's going to work. There's issues to do with Global South, who sort of feel that they're being patronised and told what they need and what they want. And the timelines generally are just not feasible. It was too short. But we have had some outcomes. So one of them is the an admission from some publishers that maybe we just need to actually just have a zero embargo. Now, this is a big thing for me personally. I've been on ranting about embargoes for a long time because the argument for embargoes generally from publishers is, oh, if we let people put things in the repository, this is the author's accepted manuscript, by the way, not the final version, into a repository at the time of publication, libraries are just going to just cancel their subscriptions en masse, which is complete garbage. There's no evidence at all to support this. And in fact, Sage and Emerald and Royal Society of Chemistry plus others have had a zero embargo for a long time with no ill effects. So finally, this message is getting through, and there is now starting to be some discussion about actually let's just allow people to put something in the repository. It's an easier way for publishers to be able to meet Plan S than having to transform their business model. Now, I said that Plan S was a set of principles and not a policy. There is one policy. It's the Wellcome Trust policy. They, and not surprisingly, given Robert Carley's role in the whole Plan S program. So what they're saying is that any paper resulting from work funded by Wellcome Trust that is submitted after the 1st of January 2020 must be compliant. That means it's got to be in a fully gold journal or in a transformative journal, and it needs to be under a CC BY license. So this may affect any of your researchers if you have Wellcome Trust funding in your institution. And again, I would put money on it that they are unaware of this requirement. Wellcome Trust are a bit vague about actually telling their researchers any detail like this. So now we're in a situation where the UK policy landscape is even more complicated than it was in 2015. So this was put together by Sally Rumsey at Oxford University, and it maps out between July to September, so into the future of this year through to 2021, 2023, and where the decision points. And you can see in those first three columns how much movement there is and timeframes, because there's situations where policies have not been determined, a lot of stuff is coming off the back of Plan S, and so until that's sort of finalised, nothing can be decided. It makes the funding situation extremely difficult when there are many, many staff in the UK in this space who are funded on soft money, and that soft money is very, very unsteady, as you can see. So we've got a mess. So this has caused endless amounts of discussion. This is a photograph I have of my home, and these are the lanyards from not all, I have to say, the conferences and so on I have been to talk about issues to do with scholarly communication, policy landscape, Plan S, etc., 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 etc. So it's certainly generating fantastic business for the conference industry and for the lanyard making industry. So yes, there's been lots of conversations. Implications for us is that the policy landscape's fast moving, it's very confusing, and that's worldwide. Australia is not immune from all of this that is happening. It is going to be affecting us in some way, shape or form. The good thing is that Plan S has focused the minds of some people in this ecosystem. So there's been a lot of attention from researchers, not all of them, but there have been researchers who've suddenly woken up and said, why we were never consulted. And it's all very odd to point out that we've been having these conversations for 20 years and they've chosen not to engage, but at least they're engaging now. So let's grab that opportunity. This is a really good opportunity to start those conversations. But we do need to broaden our focus and language to include the words open research, open scholarship, open science. We need to be being broader. Now, the reason why is, meanwhile, while all those discussions are going on and we're talking about policies and we're talking about metrics and all this sort of stuff, what's actually happening is that big publishing organisations are moving their business models away from publishing and moving them into information management. And this is a now slightly out of date graphic which identifies the research life cycle and where Elsevier-owned products sit on the researcher life cycle. Now, you'll note that all of these products are not branded Elsevier. What Elsevier's done is bought up these companies, retained the original branding of those companies, and just brought them into the Elsevier ecosystem. So it's very easy for an institution, for example, where the research office might be making purchasing decisions in one hand and the library might be making purchasing decisions in another, and IT or individual faculties or schools might be making their own decisions, to suddenly discover that you're actually living in an Elsevier ecosystem. And you may or may not have had the conversations about how you extract your data if you were to walk away from that product. Can you extract your data? And if you can, is it in any usable form? These are really serious questions we need to be thinking about. Now, this is a slide that was presented at the European Commission, but it's a slide of a slide that was presented by somebody at Elsevier, a bit confusing. But anyway, look at how this is pitched. Look how Elsevier are pitching the same story, which is, we embrace, support and enable the principles of open science. Maybe, maybe not. Now, Elsevier is doing all sorts of interesting things. They've got what is something that currently called not a commercial product. It's called Data Search. They are indexing publicly available data sets, including, rather irritatingly from my point of view, Apollo, the University of Cambridge repository, because it has the largest number of institutional data sets in the UK. The metadata from that repository is CC0. It's in the public domain. It is perfectly legal what Elsevier is doing. It's just irritating. Now, it's not a commercial product at the moment, but there is an asterisk, they do actually say at the moment on their webpage. So potentially they will be monetizing this product, presumably if there's interest in it, which means they'll be monetizing the work that is being done in institutions like Cambridge. Now, Elsevier is not alone here. There are lots of other companies that are consolidating as well. Digital Science is the owner of Symplectic Elements. You may be using it in your institution. They also own things like Overleaf and Altmetrics. You can start to see a pattern here. And they can support you at every stage of your research life cycle. So again, they also have products across the research life cycle. They're more open about the fact that they're all owned by Digital Science. But Digital Science is owned by the same parent company as Springer Nature. They insist they're separate companies and they insist that they're not integrated, but they are owned by the same parent company. And when you think that more than 50% of research is being published by five publishers, and one of them is Elsevier and one of them is Springer Nature, it starts to really question the focus of the market. Now, really, why would you even, as an institution, offer research data management services? Because you can just use Mendeley data, comprehensive research data management, or you could use research data support from Springer Nature. Springer Nature's research data support charges you £265 per data set to put it into a repository. The repository they use is Figshare. Figshare is owned by Digital Science, which is in turn owned by the same company that owns Springer Nature. Now, you could actually just put your data into Figshare for free, by the way, but anyway, you could just use these services. Well, actually, come to think of it, who needs an office for research or even a library or student services? Because the Researcher Academy at Elsevier allows you to unlock your research potential, and you can do a whole lot of modules and through the Researcher Academy on how to work through the publication process and writing for research and navigating peer review and so on. Or if you want to understand increasing your student services, you can just turn to Wiley. So what are the implications here? Publishers are muscling in, and they're better resourced than libraries because, I don't know, maybe because they're resourced by libraries. So we really, as institutions particularly, need to take a global view of our infrastructure landscape across the whole institutions. If we spend all our time focused on just the research outputs, let's make sure that the paper is open access, let's make sure the research data behind it is open access, and blind ourselves to what else is involved in the research lifecycle, the conversations, the discussions, the interesting stuff, then we might sort of turn around and go, look, all of our stuff's open access, but realise that everything else is not. It's been shut down and is now behind a paywall. So, did I mention open research? Okay, so summary and suggestions. So in relation to cancellations, we need much, much better data about what we're doing, about our publication behaviour, about our article processing expenditure, and also about our contribution into the publishing landscape. We need to take the front foot in relation to the scientific credibility question and make sure that we are above question. We need to look at metrics and look at how the rules are determining behaviour. We need to question those rules. We need to consider about the policies, about open access being the endpoint, but the journey also needs to be open as well. And in terms of being blindsided in research infrastructure, we need to take a global view. And I strongly suggest getting procurement involved in decisions that involve research supports infrastructure in terms of the research lifecycle. So that's all I've got to say, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Great, thank you very much, Dani. That was a fantastic tour de force through a huge amount of stuff that's going on. I think we all sort of feel slightly overwhelmed in the same way that you've kind of indicated with the policy sort of explosion, that things have really accelerated here very recently and, well, everywhere. But it's particularly good to see that, you know, we're not just the only parts of the world that are sort of struggling with this. So I'm going to open this up for questions now. Just a couple of things to remind people. So first off, that please type them into the chat room. That's probably the easiest way to go through it, and I'll read them out and get Dani to respond. Also, just a couple of things to note that Peter Green has put into the chat room, one of which is that the Call has recently developed a statement on open scholarship, and which was heavily influenced by work from around the world. Peter led the group that did that. I was one of the people that was involved in it. There's a whole group across Australia that did that, and that really does, I think, talk into some of the things that you're mentioning, the need for this to be about open scholarship more widely. And also just to note that Martin Borschut, who's the chair of the AOSG, was interviewed on Late Night Live, and that link is now up. Okay, so the first question that Peter's got is about, can you talk more about efforts to measure article processing charges? I think that's a really big issue for everyone.
Yeah, so obviously in the UK, the block grants are easy because you're doing all the reporting, and certainly at Cambridge, we were making all of that information openly accessible. And that is quite a useful resource because it does give a sort of, because there's such a lot of money involved, it does start to give you numbers about trends in article processing charge costs in terms of how much different publishers are charging, what average article processing charges are over time, that sort of thing. That's really helpful. The problem is the hidden stuff, the stuff we don't know about. So I did a thought piece in 2013 on this and actually went the other way. What I first tried to do was, let's look at the publishing sort of cost code in the university, and ANU was very helpful and they did give me that cost code and the details, but it only had information in relation to things like photocopying charges or printing for marketing materials. It was not publishing in the context of what we call publishing. So that was completely useless. So I went the other way around and looked at all of the publications that were in the by PLOS and from Biomed Central, because they're fully open access journals, and then worked backwards from there in terms of the Australian authors. Now at the time, this was 2013, that alone indicated around an expenditure of $9 million a year from Australia, so it was significant. The problem had been that you couldn't identify hybrid at the time, and it's really only recently you started to be able to identify hybrid, so there was this hidden cost as well. So that's one way of going about it, what's been published at hybrid and working backwards from that. Of course, the problem with that is you don't know who actually paid the article processing charge in collaborative works. I mean, if you've got all Australian authors, somebody in Australia did, so you could do an Australian-wide analysis. The way we were approaching it in Cambridge just before I left was a slightly different way, which was that we worked out what the supplier codes were. So rather than a cost code, looked at the supplier codes so that we could then ask how much per year are we paying that particular supplier? So let's say, I don't know, Sage. And so you could say, well, we know that we've paid X in subscriptions and Y in article processing charges, but the amount that we've paid overall to Sage is Z. And so the gap between those two is the amount of money that's been spent in article processing charges, one assumes, that is the hidden amount that we're trying to establish and try to at least get some concept of the scale. Now, I think it would be helpful if I know that at the moment publishing costs are not a sort of like a reportable line in things like Australian Research Council grants. It would be really helpful if it were, because the Australian Research Council is not, even if they had all the will in the world to say we want to push their open access agenda and we want to provide funds for it, there's no extra funds, unlike in the UK. So, but they are spending money on article processing charges. They just don't have any quantification of how much. So if they had a reporting line that said, you know, I bought 15 APCs and they at X cost and blah, 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 at least you start to get some indication about how much expenditure that is, so that you could then say, all right, from now on, we're going to extract that from the pot and you can get your grant, but you don't get that extra money for publishing, because you now need to take that money from a central pot, and that central pot can then have rules around it in relation to what it can be spent on. That is an approach I think we need to take. And I think we probably need to just make a decision to start doing these sorts of accountabilities now, so that in a year, 2 years time, we've got that data. Because any attempt to do it in terms of asking researchers or other aspects is not really scalable and is going to be a guess, I think. So we need to be much more systematic about trying to get this information.
Great. Thank you very much. There's clearly a lot of pieces that have to be pulled together here, but that's very helpful. Okay, I'm just going to go through a few more questions. So another one from Peter, which is about, well, more of a comment really, which is that there is this view that the final accepted manuscript is very much the second best to the final version, and that's proving an impediment on the road to open access, particularly when, you know, as in Australia, green is the favoured route. I just wondered if you wanted to comment on that in the context of the UK in particular.
Yeah, so this is a problem. So it depends on what you're trying to achieve. Making the author's accepted manuscript available opens up the research to people who are not able to otherwise read the work. And if that's what your goal is of open access, then you've achieved it through author's accepted manuscripts. Where it's considered to be the poor cousin is an issue because of the reward system and what is valued in the reward system. So we have situations, we know, where there are institutions that are putting funds into publication in a hybrid journal and paying for open access in that hybrid journal when they have a perfectly good repository and put the work into the repository and have the same citation advantage, because there's this perception that we need to pay for it to be open access, for it to be fancy pants. This is a real issue, because it comes down to the question about what are we trying to achieve when we're doing open access? What is it that open access is trying to do? And there's lots of different answers to that question. One of them, of course, is just opening up the research to a wider audience, in which case the green version solves the problem. The second one might be that it's sort of like to reduce the cost of publishing overall. And that's where we start to find that actually that's been perverted and we're putting more in because of the gold open access agenda in terms of hybrid and so on. So the answer, that there's no simple answer to that question, and that it comes back to this reputational issue, and that's the academic reward system. And we're kind of at an impasse on that one right now.
Great, thank you for that. The next one is from Cheryl Hamill, but actually I might actually, if you don't mind, answer it first and then get your perspective on it. So Cheryl's asked the question, are there any organisations in Australia that are coordinating a nationwide response that will pick up on all the problems you've identified? I'll just say quickly what we've been doing from the point of view of the Australasian Open Access Strategy Group and in coordination with CALL is that this was exactly the issue that we have identified, that there is no overall coordinating group. And we made a submission last year to a House of Representatives inquiry into actually the funding of research and made a strong recommendation that there was a need for a coordinating body to develop a national strategy. And that was became one of the final recommendations of that committee. Unfortunately, as you all know, we've had an election since then and that committee has since dissolved and we hope that it will reconstitute and pick up on that recommendation. There is clearly a need for this. But Danny, I mean, I think it'd be good to hear what your thoughts are. What worked in the UK perhaps for the coordination?
Well, I think the thing came centrally, the whole push with the Finch report and so on, moving into this whole money coming through. And there were, a couple of years ago, there was like a white paper and a green paper and all sorts of different coloured papers that ended up resulting in the development of UK research and innovation. So before, the Research Councils UK was not really a body that had any clout. It was at the sort of overlay across each of the individual councils, and they kind of did their own thing, and then the Central Research Councils UK kind of didn't have any. We'd sort of ask them questions like, there's a disconnect between the central policy and the policy, let's say, of Medical Research Council. Which one should we take as they'd always say, oh, we'll just leave it up to the institution. It was extremely unhelpful. So now that UK Research and Innovation, which is a sort of government, you know, endorsed body that has absorbed the Research Councils UK, they're all individual research councils still, but also what was the funding part of the Higher Education Funding Council for England, which looks after the Research Excellence Framework, they're all in together. And so there is this now much more of a sort of overview that is centralised at a really high level, which is the government level, that has Sir Mark Walport sitting at the top. Now he was the person at Wellcome Trust when Wellcome Trust in 2003-2004 started looking at the open agenda. So it's having the voice at the high table, and having the voice at the high table that actually understands the situation and is prepared to, you know, kick a few heads. We don't have that at the moment here, but you know, we do have a new government, I know it's the same government we just had, but it's got a new ministry. Scott Morrison's now got his own kind of mandate to go forward. He's not carrying on the previous one. I think there are opportunities for us to really start, knocking on a few doors, and that's what AOSG is doing. So that's fantastic.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. So yes, definitely more opportunities. Okay, I'm going to zoom through some more quick questions. So Amanda Lawrence had a question about how are the engagement and impact assessment exercises in the UK and now in Australia changing things? And just to note, Amanda was previously at APO Online and so did a lot of work around making the grey literature in particular open.
Yeah, so it's interesting because I was unaware that the engagement impact agenda had sort of started up here until just before I came back. I was like, oh, that's interesting. So they, in the 2014 Research Excellence Framework, they had an impact sort of component, and people needed to put together case studies. And I listened to a talk of one of the people who sort of did the analyses of the case studies once I got over there. And he was talking about how difficult they had found the sort of analysis and marking of them, if you put it that way, because they hadn't really put together a sort of template. They kind of left it up to people to do whatever they thought a case study was. And of course, nobody really knew what impact was at the time, because it happens outside the academy, so it's very difficult to quantify. I mean, how do you demonstrate that the work you've done has stopped people considering suicide, for example? It's very, very difficult to measure. So the second time around, so the current Research Excellence Framework, the impact section of how much impact is sort of like percentage of what it counts for is larger this time. So a lot of the institutions are now putting in kind of whole areas which are looking at impact. And I went to a talk just before leaving, which was from one of the sort of dame so-and-so, who's very high up on one of the assessment panels in this sort of area. And what she was trying to really emphasise was publication in Nature or Science isn't impact. And a lot of people were writing about those sorts of things as though that meant something. So the impact agenda is quite tricky, because it's forget that, And it's not just that it got mentioned in lots of newspapers or the articles. And I don't know if you saw the recent sort of controversy about that particular manuscript that somebody had from Bristol University claimed to interpreted the language, and this has been some mystery for a long time, rah, rah, rah. And then it turned out that it was sort of questioned, and then Bristol took down its press release about it, and it's got a very high altmetric score. But if you look at what the altmetric, if you look at the news stories and the discussion, it's actually about the controversy, not about the piece itself. So altmetrics and discussion in the media in itself is not either, does not impact either. It's really looking at sort of like what are the outcomes into the future, you know, where does this hit the real world? The good thing about the impact agenda, and particularly from the open perspective, is that I think the two are linked. So if you are starting your research process with the impact agenda in mind, what are we trying to achieve? What is the potential impact out there with whatever it is that we're doing? How will we build our research program to ensure that we are, one, collecting that information as we go along? So instead of just putting on an exhibition, put on an exhibition and put them things around it so that when you're talking to people, you're actually asking them beforehand, what was your opinion beforehand, and then maybe following afterwards and saying, now, how do you feel about X? Putting all that stuff in at the beginning, it's like doing an ethics approval, pain in the bum to do, but really useful later on in the project. So similar sorts of stuff. But the good thing about the open agenda is that it's very hard to have impact if nobody's heard of your work because it's stuck behind a paywall. So this is where we really need to start looking at anything that is published should be open access, and therefore that then feeds on to things like interpretive materials that explain the work in understandable language that then pushes out into the community. So I think that impact agenda is quite valuable for us. We just need to harness it in the open space.
Yeah, I think that's right. And it's certainly something that resonates when you do talk to academics. It's great to be able to show things like links between citations and downloads and open access. It's pretty comprehensive. Okay, next question is from David Groningen about really just a comment, really, which is he says that it's worth noting that all the digital science company founders will tell you that they own their companies and that Holtzbring are only investors, but obviously it doesn't change your overall message about the publisher's strategy, but it is a different one to the Elsevier one. Do you want to comment on that, Danny? Is that something that's kind of been an issue, or do you think it doesn't really change how we should sort of work with these companies?
Those two examples are the ones that are the most obvious. I personally don't feel that digital science is malicious. They seem to be, their products are quite good products, and you know, Daniel Hook was an academic himself, so they are actually coming from an academic standpoint. And the whole reason why Simplectics was built in the first place was because they got sick of typing in the same stuff over and over again, thought there has to be a better way. So it comes from a different space originally. It's not a publishing company. It's always been a research support company. So I don't actually have like ethically an issue with digital science. It's just a good demonstration of the concentration of the market. You know, we've got things like Clarivate Analytics, which has bought out Publons, which is now linked to Researcher ID, which of course is Web of Science. And Clarivate is the company that bought out Thomson Reuters, which bought out ISI. So that's another sort of concentration there. Then we've got things like Ex Libris, and that's not only developing things like Esploro, which is its own sort of repository, sort of impacty kind of thing, but it's also bought out ProQuest, and so on. There's a whole lot of stuff happening with Ex Libris. We know that Microsoft has bought out GitHub. So these companies are just shrinking and shrinking and shrinking into these monoliths. And so we just need to be aware. There's nothing wrong with any of these products. It's just going in with your eyes open and making procurement decisions about getting your data out. Is there an open source option within the kind of infrastructure strategy of your institution? Is open source even supported? But if it is, maybe you should consider that first. And those sorts of things, you know, diversification of your portfolio, basically, ensuring that you're not all eggs in one basket, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, absolutely. I'll make a quick plug here for a new initiative called Invest in Open, which is exactly trying to support and develop and also map the landscape of open initiatives within scholarly communication so that we do actually have open source alternatives. All right, we're almost running out of time, but there's one that I really want to get to, which is from Richard White at Otago. So he said, great talk, very timely. And I said, near the start, you mentioned the French approach to their new deal with green OA built in. Could you explain what is the nature of this green, i.e. standard sharing terms which allow green on accepted manuscript after embargo? And later on, you suggested that zero embargo for author manuscripts might become standard.
Yeah, I don't know the details of the French one. The copyright law in France is different to other parts of the of Europe, and that only changed not that long ago. It's probably less than a year ago. So there's actually legal restrictions in France that are, well, in some ways, I think they're more open than other, the restrictions. I'm not being very clear here, but I'd need to go into that in more detail. I don't want to answer on the record and say the wrong thing. I know, but it is interesting to note that for all of the Europe stuff, that Germany, for example, is not able to sign up to Plan S because there is actually a legal right of authors there to publish where you wish in a way that there isn't elsewhere, for example. So Plan S would be in contravention of that law. So so the individual laws of individual countries do actually, in some cases, affect the policies sitting around open access. Can I get back to people on that one? I'll do some reading.
Yeah, thank you. Actually, Rich has just noted that the French copyright law is stronger for authors than it is in the elsewhere. So it's actually a really nice example of how things are going to be, will have to be managed differently country by country. These are not simple policies that can apply automatically. All right, I think just one more question, then we'll stop on the hour. So this is from Peter Nish. He says, do you know of anyone who's quantified institutional contribution to input into deal negotiations? And if so, how have they done that?
We did it at Cambridge, and I haven't written it up yet because it's very complicated. We ended up having to ask the publishers for the data, thinking they all had it. I thought we were going to negotiations, they were laughing behind their hands at us because they knew everything. They actually don't. Their data is not clean at all. So we were only able to really get complete data for one of our publishers. It took a huge amount of cleaning up. I had to employ somebody just to do all the manipulation of the information. We ended up coming down to 5 years, and dates are really important in relation to, because when we sort of said between X and Y date, except they were doing the refereeing that occurred in that period and then the publishing. And so the refereeing were not necessarily for the works that were published in the same time period. It's very complex. So we ended up working out, here's 5 years divided by five. So on an average year with that publisher, this is what our contribution was. Now, what was interesting was the downloads were ginormous, and so, which looked to be at student downloads by the pattern through the year. Citations were fairly low. That was kind of an interesting thing. But when we looked at the number of peer reviews that were done by Cambridge authors for that publisher, even if we only charged £200 per peer review, that eclipsed the amount we were spending in the subscription. So it really does start to put to question why we are not asking for this information. And I think that we should be putting this into our negotiations. When we subscribe, we say, we want this information from you on an annual basis. What we're publishing with you, because that's hard to establish as well. Easy to establish what's being published in what journal, but not what's been published with which publisher. That's quite difficult to establish. And then how much we're referring for you, how much we're editing for you. We should be getting that just as basic information every year from our publishers. They'll complain and say it's going to cost some extra money and we should pay them more, but they really should be giving us that information.
So that's a fascinating note to end on. So I think hopefully everybody's going away and rewriting their contracts as we speak. So we're on the hour, so we'll stop now. Thanks, Danny. That was a tremendous talk. Lots of really good things to pick up on there. Just a reminder, we'll make the recording and the slides available, and Danny's put them on SlideShare already. We will have another webinar in a month or so, so keep your eyes out for that. And thanks to everyone else for joining. Bye.